This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Maureen Quilligan says that to understand historical figures, we should consider much more than the historical record. Professor Quilligan specializes in Renaissance literature at Duke University, and she looks at poems and correspondence and plays to tease out a more dynamic picture of the people and politics that ruled Europe in the 16th century. She's the author of four scholarly texts that cover such topics as allegory, female authority, and the role of incest in Elizabethan English. Now she's at work on a new book, one aimed at a broader audience. It's titled When Women Ruled the World, The Glorious 16th Century. Maureen Quilligan joins us now. Welcome to the program. Good to have you here.
Oh, it's wonderful to be here, Frank.
Everything was good until you said the glorious 16th century, and then you lost me. But that it was an amazing century for women, and it's something, and we don't think about it that way, do we?
Well, I think a lot of people, particularly in the Anglophone, English-speaking world, understand that Elizabeth was a very important part of the English Renaissance. What I'm hoping to be able to do is to talk about the relationships between Elizabeth and Mary, Queen of Scots, and which we all think we know that story. But I think I want to tell it differently by bringing Catherine of Médicis, who was then the regent, la reine mère of France at the time, and to talk about how these, particularly three women, although there are many other women who were ruling at the time, but particularly these three women understood the shared challenges they faced in being in the anomalous position of having power while being women. And my suggestion is the glory of the 16th century. Elizabeth was called Gloriana, so by Edmund Spenser, which is why I probably call it glorious. The particular glory, as well as the gore, of the 16th century is due to the fact that they were trying very hard to allay the violence of the confessional conflicts that were going on at the time. And they also understood that the their male politic bodies were deeply disturbed by having female leaders.
Well, tell us a little bit more about, start with this relationship between Elizabeth and Mary, because after all, Elizabeth did have Mary beheaded eventually.
After 18 long years.
In prison.
After 18 long years, when they were asking her to execute her immediately. So this is one of the interesting things about I think you should write my book. I love that introduction. It's so much better than I would have said it. The reason why I think historians have missed some of the interesting materials there are out there is because they tend not to read literature qua literature. And I think there's a wonderful hint of the relationship between Mary, Queen of Scots, and Elizabeth in a book of poetry that Catherine of Médicis had sent to Elizabeth by Pierre de Ronsard. And in that book, there's lots and lots of poems. It's a thick little book. One of the poems is written to William Cecil, Lord Burleigh, with a pun on his name. His name was pronounced Cecil, and so Ronsard figures you came from Sicily. Sicily is the place where there's a huge Titan, a volcano where a Titan was pinned down by God. And Ronsard tells Cecil and Elizabeth and everybody that you have to be very careful to support kings because God wants kings to serve on earth. At the time this happened, just actually 4 years earlier, Cecil had been very much involved with the lords of the congregation in Scotland, had sent a whole bunch of money to the Scottish lords so they could contest Mary, Queen of Scots' authority.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you look at the poetry, you can see Ronsard and Catherine of Médicis know that Elizabeth's right-hand man is really not a supporter of monarchy.
And other authors are contending with this as well, including Shakespeare.
Right. Yes.
And we can see this most vividly, and you use it in your class, maybe not most vividly, but in A Midsummer Night's Dream. It comes clear that he's in that this is something that Shakespeare himself is contending with, or would like his playgoers to think about.
Right, absolutely.
So tell, well, and actually we have a clip. Maybe we should play that clip.
Yeah,
and if you will set up this particular moment in A Midsummer Night's Dream that we're about to hear, and then we'll come back and talk about how this reflects some of the tensions of the time of having a female regent.
Okay. You want me to tell you what the...
Yeah.
Okay. A bunch of lovers have run away from Athens to because Theseus, the big Athenian duke, is... has told Hermia that she needs to either die, as her father wants her to do, or marry the man she wants to marry, or Theseus gives her a third option, which is to become a virgin, which is to chant cold hymns to the faint hymns to the cold, fruitless moon, so that virginity is a deeply and profoundly problematic thing from the get-go. Oberon, who's the king of the fairies, is trying to get a little Indian boy away from the queen of the fairies, and she won't do it. The fairy land buys not this child of me, she says. And so he's going to trick her into giving up the Indian boy.
All right, let's listen.
Thou rememberest, since once I sat upon a promontory and heard a mermaid on a dolphin's back uttering such dulcet and harmonious breath, that the rude sea grew civil at her song. That very time I saw that thou couldst not, flying between the cold moon and the earth, Cupid, all armed. A certain aim he took, and loosed his love shaft smartly from his bow. Yet marked I where the bolt of Cupid fell. It fell upon a little western flower, before milk-white, now purple with love's wound. Fetch me that flower. The juice of it on sleeping eyelids laid will make all man, all woman madly dote upon the next live creature that it sees. Fetch me this herb. And be thou here again ere the Leviathan can swim a league.
I'll put a girdle round about the earth in 40 minutes.
Having once this juice, I'll watch Titania when she's asleep and drop the liquor of it in her eyes. The next thing then she waking looks upon, she shall pursue it with the soul of love. And ere I take this charm from off her sight, I'll make her render up her page to me.
Right, there we have a little bit of a 1999 film version of A Midsummer Night's Dream. Maureen Quilligan, Duke English professor, is here talking about how Shakespeare was actually dealing with the Virgin Queen, although, interestingly enough, in that rendition, it left out some of the key language that would have been important to him back when he wrote this.
Mm-hmm. And important to his audience, because he is referring specifically to, scholars are now agreed, Queen Elizabeth and her very empowering virginity, which the play is very much dedicated to containing and erasing the power of. As you just heard Rupert Holmes, I think, Rupert, beautiful, wonderful conversational style in that particular clip. He says, "But thou couldst not, flying between the cold moon and the earth, Cupid all armed. A certain aim he took," and this is one of the lines they cut, "at a fair vestal throned by the west, and loosed his love shaft smartly from his bow, as it should pierce 100,000 hearts. But I might see young Cupid's fiery shaft quenched," and this they cut, "in the chaste beams of the watery moon, and the imperial votress pass it on in maiden meditation, fancy free." And then we'll go on to where I note where the bolt of Cupid fell on the flower that turned red with love's wound. Having Elizabeth be present there is the imperial votress who was not harmed by Cupid's fiery shaft, who passes on in maiden meditation, fancy free, is made to be the absolute unique sort of avatar of female virgin sovereignty. And virginity itself is not something that is a model that other women should follow. And in fact, the entire play is dedicated to taking all the symbols that have been associated with Elizabeth's virginity, the chaste beams of the watery moon, and turning them into masculine objects. For instance, the wound at the very opening of the play for Theseus is an old dowager who withers out a young man's revenues. But to Hippolyta, the Amazon queen, it's an Amazonian bow, new bent in heaven. And there's much talk about the moon. But at the very end of the play, we get to the little play within a play, Pyramus and Thisbe, where the moon has become the man in the moon. And by such imaginative means, which not go by reason, this is not a reasonable play, it's about the qualities of the imagination, a culture responds to the anomaly of the female power at the time. And I'm not surprised that they write the lines out, because it's a kind of historical pressure that a modern production probably can't deal with.
So it may not be so useful to modern audiences, but to someone who wants to find out what societies were dealing with and how they were coping, that kind of literature is critical. We're going to talk more about that, what you see in that, why the agency, as you said, the power of virginity when it's intentional on the part of the queen, was so threatening. We'll talk more about that and the life and career of Maureen Quilligan, Duke English professor who is with us on The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow, talking today with Duke English professor Maureen Quilligan. She's working on a new book to be titled When Women Ruled the World, The Glorious 16th Century, and it takes a look at what was going on, particularly three regions in Europe, who Catherine, Mary, Queen of Scots, and Elizabeth I, all of whom were ruling at around this period. And literature, you think, is a better insight, gives us a better view at the dynamics, the social dynamics of people coming to terms with this. Virginity is important. We think of men sort of supporting virginity. This is the pillar of male of patriarchal rule. We will control your virginity. But here we're threatened by virginity. Here, for some reason, Shakespeare and others can't get their head around it because the queen has chosen it for herself. Tell us a bit, expand this and give us some insight into this paradox.
Well, as you were hinting, I think, the mere fact that Elizabeth chose it makes it her own choice, she stops the traffic in women. She halts her traffic in women. She was never actually married out because neither her father nor her brother could use her as a pawn in the traffic in women, where, you know, you marry into a different dynasty and try to make a political connection, because, in fact, her father had executed her mother for incest. And, in fact, he himself, Henry VIII, had committed incest when he married Elizabeth, because he had previously had a sexual relationship with Anne Boleyn's older sister, and so he'd actually asked the Pope for a dispensation to marry Anne Boleyn to dispense with incest, even at the same time he was getting rid of Catherine of Aragon for the very same reasons. So the block on her being trafficked in, being married off to someone else, started long before her own choices. She came to the throne at 25. And I think we forget, because her virginity was so incredibly important, and she said so much that she didn't want to marry ever, that in fact she had been at one point willing to marry another royal suitor. Then the Prince of France. And many people think that she was not serious about that, except so many people objected to it later in life. She was older at that particular point. So many people objected to it. I think, in fact, she probably was really very serious about it. People point to her lack of enthusiasm and her insincerity in marrying the Duc d'Alençon, her frog, as she called him, because she wrote a letter when he died to Catherine de Médicis, talking much more about their relationship with each other than the mother's loss of a son and her loss of a potential lover. But I would like to point at that letter and say, yes, the important relationship for Elizabeth was not with any one of Catherine's sons, but with Catherine herself, who was the power in France running it. So I think it's not so much virginity, and it's not so much getting married that is upsetting to men. It's the fact that females take agency upon themselves and will do what they think is right to do at any given point, be it virginity or actually getting married.
It actually sheds interesting light on something that's perplexing for a lot of people, and that is now in the Catholic Church and the Christian Church, the idea of the virgin martyr, which mm-hmm. always seems perverse in the 21st century, the mm-hmm. idea that this is something that you would hold dear and in any way glorify. But the virgin martyrs were really standing up to their fathers saying, mm-hmm. I won't marry, which put them at odds with Roman law, mm-hmm. which meant mm-hmm. that's how they were martyred. And mm-hmm. so in a sense, it's a kind of proto-feminism.
It absolutely is. And you have just understood more about the first proto-feminist history of women by a woman than many scholars who've been working on it for a long time, Frank. So congratulations. Christine de Pizan wrote in 1405 the Livre de la Cité des Dames, the Book of the City of Ladies, which was an allegorical construction of a city where women would be safe, but she was telling the history of women from Greek to French times through mythological figures and historical figures. But the last part of it was a martyrology, a series of virgin martyrs. And of course, all the feminist scholars who started working on this were deeply disturbed. How could this be? How could the sort of piecemeal mutilation of female bodies be in any way conducive to a female agency? But indeed, it is exactly what you said, that these women were objecting to the patriarchal times, and they were willing to martyr themselves for their own agency. And martyrdom is a very, very powerful tool. Many people thought that martyrdom wasn't, but I think we understand if you're willing to martyr yourself for a cause, you can do very, very powerful things in this world. I won't go on.
No, but it looks like feminism now, it cast in that light. But was it then? In other words, how do we contextualize, or how do we understand this in its own context?
I think in its own context, it was really very important, because Christine de Pizan also wrote the only signed poem about Joan of Arc during Joan of Arc's lifetime. So, in fact, the first professional woman of letters was absolutely contemporaneous with the first woman warrior. People ask, why did the royal court give her an army? Well, for 30 years, Christine de Pizan had been telling that very same royal court that women were capable of rule, capable of running armies, capable of doing anything that they wanted to do. And then she actually ended up writing a poem and said, "See, I told you so."
How did you get interested in all of this?
I was an activist in my undergraduate days, and I think I had the normal trajectory of an activist, going from politics to self-consciousness about not merely liberal politics and radical politics, but also feminist politics. And I was in an action group in Oxford. And I suddenly realized at some point that it was possible to get the two together, to get activism together with scholarship. I co-edited a collection of essays with two other women called Rewriting the Renaissance, the Discourses of Sexual Difference in Early Modern Europe. And we kept saying not sisterhood is powerful, but scholarship is powerful, that what one needed to do was to rewrite the entire history of the world.
Well, you got to start somewhere.
But
and
you do.
The 16th
you
century
do.
Is as good a place as
it's
any.
It's a very good place.
Tell us about your education, too, because that journey began, the academic journey, I suppose, in some ways at the University of California at Berkeley.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it did. In the good old days of student demonstrations, somebody once said, well, that's student riots. And I said, no, there's a big difference between a riot and a demonstration. As you see in Tahrir Square, that's a demonstration. Those are not riots. They're absolutely peaceful, as were the student demonstrations, absolutely peaceful at the University of California at Berkeley. The interesting thing about those demonstrations was they were in response to the university's shutting down all political conversation on campus. So this was an election year with Goldwater was running for president. So they shut down the Goldwater tables and the Maoist little book tables. And so the students from every political spectrum said, "You are taking. We do not, should not have to surrender our political rights as citizens of this country when we step on this campus." It's nice to know they're still demonstrating in Berkeley.
That's an important idea that you carry forward: the idea of an exchange, an active exchange between students and their professors, mm-hmm. that it's not about just the classroom.
Right. Well, the classroom is everywhere. And I should say, I think probably some people have asked me, why did I come to Duke? I started my career at Yale and then taught at Penn, and then I've moved to Duke for the past 11 years. Why did I come? And I think it goes back to that moment at the University of California in the 60s, the day that I decided to strike my class, to go out on a student strike, to protest the arrest of 800 students from Sproul Hall Plaza, including my roommate. I had chosen not to go in. I went back and did my homework dutifully, which was to read John Milton's Areopagitica, which is about free speech. And when I walked back on campus and the students had been arrested, I decided not to go to that Milton class, but to become part of the student demonstrations, which was lots of fun. And that class was taught by Stanley Fish, who had been the very famous chair of the Duke English Department, who had put the Duke English Department on the map in terms of just general cultural understandings. That English Department had suffered, was ended up on the front page of the New York Times, which I think most English departments suffer the same kinds of things that English department was suffering, but they don't end up on the front page of the New York Times because they're not headed by Stanley Fish.
Academic raiding, I think.
Yes, raiding. Yes, he did academic raiding. But he also made the argument that literary studies, English studies, the English department are crucial to any interesting cultural activity. And so when I was asked if I would consider chairing the department, moving from Penn to come to Duke to chair it, there was this kind of legacy that I felt I could not say no to supporting. So in some funny way, it sounds strange, but I see my chairing of the Duke English Department as very much a part and parcel of my scholarship plus my activism from so long ago.
What were the challenges that you faced? Because, as you said, the department was by that time on the pages of the New York Times, and there was a sense that a lot of scholars had been lost to other institutions and that it was in disarray, that there was some confusion in that department.
Yes, I think there had been. The thought was there was some confusion in that department. I think, however, as most confusions go, it was simply that the previous amount of resources that had been given to the department to build it were necessarily going elsewhere, and that it caused problems. In each case, the losses were not ideological, they were sheerly practical. And so what I thought I could do was to come back in to build the department was also to make the actions of the department much more democratic. What's sort of odd about my doing When Women Rule the World is to talk about the ways in which queens are resisting a proto-republican challenge to their power, when in fact I'm a real dyed-in-the-wool Democrat. I know one Duke administrator said to me, "You want to run the English department democratically? But Maureen, the Duke English department is not ready for democracy." I said, "I can't believe you would say that." People who've gone through eighth grade civics classes and, had grammar school elections and so on and so forth can't be ready for democracy, then no one is.
Well, let's get back to our Renaissance queens on that note. Not that they were pushing for democracy, but was there something different about the kind of rule that they would have spread had they been allowed to continue, had that sort of rule? Was there anything fundamentally different about their relationship and their individual regencies?
They were definitely not pushing democracy. They were arguing for the divine right of kings because it was only on the basis of their dynastic accident, the fact that they happened to be born women into these royal families, that they could in any way claim to rule. And so the challenge to them comes from proto-republicanism. John Knox himself says in the second blast of the monstrous regiment, of the trumpet against the monster regiment of women, that just because you're born to rule doesn't mean you should rule. There's a really long history of democracy going. I think what was interesting about these women's rule was that they, as the Republicans, proto-Republicans understood, they, by the very disability of their femaleness, suggested the fissures there were, the problems there are in monarchy. It works much better if boy, you know, father, son, father, son, father, son. When you have father, daughter, then you have the static of gender. And I think the Republicans used the static of gender to wheedle a passage for what was ultimately going to become the regicide in the 17th century. But I think the glory of what these women did is their real attempt over and over and over again to stop warring and to put all of the cultural force of a country not into warfare but into arts production. It's particularly the case with Catherine de' Medici's. Elizabeth herself was never let her aristocrats run all of the culture for her. Catherine de Médicis actually started, you know, the ballet began at Catherine de Médicis' court. She had incredible spectacles and festivities and profound works of art created. I think she was responsible for the Valois tapestries at, currently at the Uffizi. All of these beautiful art objects and this great literature under Elizabeth is a response to the anomaly of female rule at this time.
There had been kings who sponsored the arts.
Yes, they had sponsored the arts, but you know, Henry VIII went to war whenever he could, and Elizabeth never did. And it was much easier to for women to exercise their power through the arts than because they can't actually. I mean, Elizabeth got dressed up and went in armor down to Tilbury and gave a great speech, but she didn't actually fight. Whereas.
Well, and she was, after all, she did reign over perhaps the greatest military victory in English history over the Spanish Armada.
Yes, but that was God's victory.
I see. You never ascribed that one to the girl, huh?
No, I think they ascribe it to the girl because they have allowed that she only ruled. The point was you could either, as a woman, you could either rule as a monster, as Knox said, or you could rule as a miracle. And that's what Knox said to Elizabeth. Don't think that you are ruling by anything in your own abilities. It's only because God has chosen you and that you must be ever grateful. For her part, Elizabeth never let Knox travel through her kingdom, however much he might apologize, and it was not really very apologetic. So I think the Armada works into the remarkable myth of her virginity, that she was impregnable in every way and that God was going to see to it that she would be impregnable. The reason why I think the Armada lost the battle was because Philip II would not let them land the soldier forces on English soil, as the English had quite intelligently assumed they would, but made the Armada go all the way into the Netherlands to pick up some more troops. Had they actually landed and made the British start to fight, the land forces were so weak they would have collapsed.
Let's talk a little bit about how this book, the one that you're writing, came about, because as I mentioned, you've written a number of scholarly texts. This one you're writing for a broader audience, and I suppose we should point out that you're living in Hillsborough and married to best-selling author Michael Malone, also Emmy Award-winning TV writer.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that has something to do with how this particular book got to be, or got as far as it is now, perhaps.
Well, I should say, yes. I actually was up in my study. We weren't in North Carolina at that point. I was up in my study, and I came down, and I said, I have a wonderful title for a book, When Women Rule the World, The Glorious 16th Century. And he was talking to his agent at the time. He said, oh, Maureen just came in with a wonderful book. And the agent said, I'll buy it, you know, or I'll sell it to someone. So this book has been a long time coming. I've actually think that I have written and published all the other books I've done in order to teach myself how to write this one. Because frankly, it's quite terrifying for someone who is used to writing to a scholarly audience to be, speaking on public radio to non-scholars, and then also thinking of writing a book that will interest people who do not have a scholarly and professional interest in it, that just want to hear the stories told as well as they can.
I'll tell you what, we'll take a break and talk more about that when we return. This hour on The State of Things, Maureen Quilligan, professor of English at Duke University. There's more to come on The State of Things. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow, talking this hour with Maureen Quilligan, a professor of English at Duke. Her upcoming book is When Women Ruled the World, The Glorious 16th Century, a foray into somewhat more popular literature for you. And we talked about that transition, how that is, and I guess the blessing of having a best-selling author and a TV writer under your roof. Mm-hmm. How does that work? Do you work with Michael Malone and...
Well, I don't work with him. I admire him. I get to read all of his work back to him out loud. He says that he can tell whether or not I like something by the things that pass across my face. I don't think anything passes across my face. I'm just amazed by the exquisite richness of the language. And I guess maybe when something isn't working, I wince. I don't know. I do offer him advice, but he never takes it. He says he takes all my advice, but that's not true. But it is the greatest pleasure of my life, perhaps second only to reading Milton and reading Shakespeare. No, it's the same when I get to read Michael's exquisite language. It is not only beautiful language that I think will stand the test of centuries, as the language I normally work with already has, but it is a very popular appeal, and we have always thought, we've always assumed that the greatest art can have the greatest appeal. I was one of the benighted few who told Michael not to go into writing soap opera because I had a prejudice against popular culture, being a fancy professor. But then, and I'd never watched any soap opera, but then I saw that, in fact, the very structure of it was very much like the romances out of which Spenser wrote The Faerie Queen. He even asked me, how should I start doing this? And I said, well, have a hermit or have somebody come out of the woods and start talking about supernatural things, which is what he did. So it's been a great pleasure to me. I have a great humility in the face of his amazing talent. And of course, I've always aspired to at least appealing to a real reader. He, of course, keeps telling me I can do it. And
How much input does he have on this book?
He got his agent to take it sold the very first thing. Has kept telling me to write it, and I have avoided it by writing all these other books or scholarly things because I've needed to teach myself really how it works. And now I'm just now getting down to it, having started with the golden font, the 333-ounce golden font that Elizabeth sent to Mary Queen of Scots for the baptism of James I, and tying a whole story as that font makes its way up the great road from London to Scotland. To Edinburgh, I've never told a story like that before, but it is really becoming quite wonderful. And he's going to help me, I think.
Why is that writing different? You feel strongly about the idea that the classroom should be everywhere and it should somehow inform our work, our activism. Mm-hmm. So shouldn't all of the prose be in a form that we all touches us both in the mind and in the heart?
Oh, absolutely.
And leads us to move.
Yes, absolutely. And that's clearly why I want to do it, except it's much easier to write for someone who already knows the stories and you're just adjusting small perceptions about the adjustment of the story. And that's very, very rich. And that kind of research is really, really important because you need to know what actually, in fact, did happen. But to be able to tell a story, tell it, all of that information as a story that interests someone who doesn't know and isn't already invested in the material is a tricky thing.
So tell us more about the golden font.
Well, it the golden font was I found it in Donnington. It got as far as Donnington.
A baptismal font. Okay.
It was melted down. This is what's sort of important. It was melted down very shortly after because Mary needed money, and Elizabeth clearly understood that that would probably be the case, which is why she would have sent something that was so so important and easily transformed into money, to specie. Usually when women give gifts, it's gifts of cloth, and those last. So the gifts of cloth that Mary, Queen of Scots, herself embroidered to give to Elizabeth, we still have when she was in jail, when she was imprisoned with the Countess of Shrewsbury. And we have those amazing wall hangings, which tell a story of female agency in the same way that Christine de Pizan does. You may have heard about Hardwick Hall, more glass than wall. Have you ever heard that?
I'm sorry, I haven't.
Hardwick Hall, more glass than wall. It's a very British thing. It's about the biggest prodigy house built in Elizabethan England by the Countess of Shrewsbury, Elizabeth Bess of Hardwick. Inside, on the walls that were not glass, are these huge wall hangings that Mary, Queen of Scots, Bess, and many professional embroiderers embroidered about all these important women. And there's an interesting picture of a dress, a gorgeous dress that it's an oil painting of a dress that Bess of Hardwick was going to give to Elizabeth. Those things last because cloth gifts between women are inalienable possessions. And it's interesting that the font immediately was destroyed, although I think it is a trace of a lifelong commitment that Elizabeth had to James I. Everyone purports to be very surprised that he was the one who ended up being king, whereas I think it was clear from the moment that Mary, Queen of Scots, asked Elizabeth to be his parent should she die.
Literature has been important to you all your life. In fact, I think you said that a bookstore saved your life.
Yes, I did.
Tell us that story.
Well, I actually think that we're talking a lot about my writing, but I think maybe one of the reasons why I ended up on the meat list for your show is because I was very supportive of Sharon Wheeler, who wanted to open a bookstore in downtown Hillsboro. And I said, well, you can't have that horrible fluorescent light glaring on people as they're trying to read books, so let me make some shades for them. And so I sewed up some shades that stretched along the long fluorescent lights. So there's now this very British library glow.
With your own tapestry.
With my own tapestry. That's, very good, yes. Oh, my God, that's true. It's a gift of cloth from one woman to another. Very good, A+.
Out of all places. A bookstore, which was important to you early
right,
in
yes,
life, too.
Yes. Well, I grew up in Los Angeles, and it was the 50s of the beach blanket bingo era, just coming into Surfer Girl, and I spent a lot of time on the beach, and that was wonderful fun, and I do enjoy looking at the flat horizon of the Pacific, but its flatness and its blueness begins to wear in its absolute monotony. Mm-hmm. And I found a bookstore where I was able to buy books, and I wanted to live inside those books, and I'm lucky because I am able to live inside Michael's books. So we moved to Hillsboro because one of his books had been actually set in Hillsboro. He'd gone to the Hillsboro Town Hall. And so when we were looking for a home, when we'd accepted the Duke position, a little black and white drove by, and I said, oh, is Cuddy or Justin in that from one of his books on Civil Seasons or Times Witness or First Lady? And he's currently writing one now called Dark Winter, which is has those two policemen. So we moved inside his fiction. And that bookstore was the first place I discovered that you could live inside books and have a whole world.
How do you think students now, you're teaching, are different or the same as they were when you were coming of age in those heady days of the 60s, unquote?
I think students are the same. I know I'm a very sort of idiosyncratic person in thinking this. I think, if anything, they're better than we were. We were, of course, activists, I make no, sort of idealizing about it. People were activists because they didn't want to be drafted and they didn't want to die in a war. I think the reason why our students nowadays are not activists is because they're not literally, physically, and personally threatened, as a whole generation of students were. I don't think that students are that different now. I think they work just as hard, harder, because it costs so much more. Their parents are risking so much more of their own lives to be able to send a student to a good school to get a good education. In the days of yore at Berkeley, it cost me $75 a term to go to Berkeley. It was a great public education.
Well, it certainly has changed a lot, particularly in California, trying to get a public education. So when you think about that, when you think about building up all of that debt, what you're working hard for can change dramatically if you come out with all that debt. Can you afford to think about things like social and cultural capital when so much of your financial capital is invested in this very expensive education?
I think, yes, I think it's, you have to think about both things, as my students say, when I'm constantly saying, think about this other thing. Money is not the only value. And so much of the literature I teach is just the money's being an important value is just coming on the horizon. You know, Shylock can talk about it in The Merchant of Venice, but Chaucer is certainly thinks that anybody who cares about money is weird, a little interesting, but weird. But I do think students, all this activism, they are engaged. This whole thing called Duke Engage is not simply run by the university. It's generated by the students. They do want to go out and improve the world. They always have. They volunteer. My brother, David Malone, is in charge of an immense amount of outreach that Duke students have been doing for a long time, and I think all students have been doing for a long time.
I want to take you back now to the 16th century because you raised an interesting point. This is the rise in of money, a money economy. The aristocracy still frowns on this idea, mostly of earning your living by making money. But there we are on the threshold of this very new kind of economy, and it's also a time when we see a rise in witch burning and, of course, the period you write about with these women in power. We tend to think about women in subordinate positions forever in human history. But had things been changing? Were women a little more equal? Was there something more threatening to that emerging system about women and their freedom that at that time that made life more dangerous for them?
Well, I'm not sure it made it any more dangerous for them. I think it's been dangerous for women all along, and it's, you know, we know more about how dangerous it is for women around the world today. But I think that being vulnerable people, like children, they have always been at risk, particularly if society's turned violent. However, whenever culture gets to be civilized, women do quite well indeed. Thank you very much. I'm reminded, if you're asking about the 17th century, you know, witch burnings and so on and so forth, someone once asked Antonia Fraser, who was writing a book on the weaker vessel, women in the 17th century, a jesting club, and asked her, were there women in the 17th century? There have always been women. If there hadn't been women, there wouldn't be successive centuries. And I think it's history that makes them look, has denied them their agency. We have lost our great knowledge of how important women have been throughout all centuries and all parts of civilization. They're one half the sky. They hold up one half the sky.
Let me stop you there, because I know you've said that it's not just because men write history. There are other reasons for that.
I think it's in part because men write history, but I think the One of the problems with Catherine, say, de Médicis, is not only that men have written history, but that English speakers have written history, and Protestants, English speakers, have written history. So that there's been a kind of, you know, a Whig historiography from the throughout the 18th and 19th century, and that's what we've inherited. A wonderful colleague of mine, Meg Greer, is currently writing a book on Spanish, the tragedy of Spanish drama, Golden Age drama, which is has a much bigger corpus even than English Renaissance drama, which is utterly and absolutely ignored because Spain has been denigrated in English letters for centuries.
Well, and literature as a window into history, too, mm-hmm. that we spend maybe more time on the events and the figures, the characters of history than we do on the literature, which could, as you suggest, shine a different light and teach us more about mm-hmm. history.
Mm-hmm. Hear, hear. And I think I don't see the difference between literature and history. I think they're both together. You need to understand the historical context, and you need to understand that Elizabeth's presence is formulative for the way in which Midsummer Night's Dream works. It's one of the reasons why Midsummer Night's Dream is such a great work of art, because it's responding to one of the largest problems the culture had, which is to take care of the anomaly of Elizabeth's gender.
So in Duke Magazine, a profile there, you said, quote, that you were old and that you liked getting old.
Yes, I do like getting old. Maybe it's because I grew up in L.A. where everybody thinks they're going to stay young forever. Yeah. But I really not only wanted to look to live inside a book, but I wanted to get old, and I'm proud of it.
Why is that?
It's a wonderful place to be. I finally got enough information that I can think about things and come up at least with some of my own answers that interest me. You need to live a long time before you can, before you're sort of proof against a lot of things that people are telling you are true and in fact they're not.
Well, thank you for bringing your aged wisdom and your youthful energy to this endeavor today. Thanks so much, Maureen Quilligan.
Okay, thank you.
Maureen Quilligan's a professor of English at Duke University. Her upcoming book is titled When Women Ruled the World, The Glorious 16th Century. Thank you for listening to The State of Things. You can find us on the web, stateofthings.org, Facebook as well. Our program is produced by Amber Nimix and Alex Granados. William Kumpf and Nasser Abbas are our interns. Robin Copley's the technical director, managing editor Lindsay Foster Thomas, and our senior producer is Susan Davis. This is North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.